or older than that, then it is protected, it's protected less strongly than if it's more recent than that. And this law actually only applies to providers of electronic communication services or remote computing services. And, you know, something that is really frustrating is that the Stored Communications Act was written in 1986. And it's never really been substantially updated. And so, you know, I think that Congress was considering certain types of services at the time, electronic communication services. Okay, these are services that let people communicate with each other electronically. Remote computing services, you know, this tends to involve storage, services that store data for people. But we have providers now that do both of those things. And, you know, how do we treat them in this statutory scheme? And so this starts to get really complicated. And it's funny, you know, when you see court opinions on this, often the judges start out just by saying, okay, this is really complicated. I'm going to take my best stab at it, but this is hard. And so, you know, number one, the law needs to be updated. But, you know, number two, it just doesn't apply very well to the situation at the moment. And then there are also state laws that play into this as well. So very, very difficult, complicated situation. This stuff has come up in a couple recent cases that you may have heard about. One involved a government order to Twitter seeking information about some individuals in the WikiLeaks investigation. And EFF represents a person along with the ACLU in that case. And three of the users, our client Brigitte Jahnstadter and Jake Applebaum and Rope Gongreep, we challenged the order for non-content data sought by the government from Twitter in the WikiLeaks investigation. And unfortunately, it didn't go that well. We made Fourth Amendment arguments. We made Stored Communications Act arguments. We made First Amendment arguments based on right of association. And the court basically said, well, you know, looking at all of this, we just don't think that you have rights in this, really. So that's just kind of how that goes. You know, another one was New York versus Harris, a recent case here that involving an Occupy Wall Street protester who was charged by the police here with disorderly conduct based on his participation in a protest. And the police sent a subpoena to Twitter trying to get information about Mr. Harris's activities on Twitter over a period of three months. And that included actual content, tweets. And it appears to have extended also to direct messages, so even private content, not just content that's just out there for everybody to see. And Mr. Harris pushed back against this. Twitter filed a motion pushing back against this. The ACLU and EFF and Public Citizen, we joined together to file an amicus to support them. But unfortunately, again, the court didn't recognize the privacy interests in the way that we hoped. And so, you know, these are fights that we're working on now and continuing to work on. And I think that these are issues that organizations like ours are going to be working on for a long time. This is one of our big battles in the coming years, is trying to show the courts that there are privacy interests in data stored with third parties, and that's important. We launched a campaign a couple years ago called When the Government Comes Knocking, Who Has Your Back? And the idea was to recognize certain companies who actually have good practices along these lines. And I know you probably can't see the categories very well, but we gave various companies stars for telling users about data demands from the government. So, you know, when the government sends a data demand to Twitter, for example, we gave them a star because they have a policy of letting the customer know that, so that the subscriber can actually, like, push back against that. That can't always be the case, unfortunately, because sometimes the demand comes with a provision that says, you know, this is sensitive and you can't tell anybody. But, you know, to the extent that services are able to tell their subscribers, there are several that do. We also gave stars for companies that are transparent about government requests. There are an increasing number of companies that publish reports about this on an annual basis that say how many requests they get, what kind of requests they get. We gave stars for fighting for user privacy in the courts. and for fighting for user privacy in Congress, because as I mentioned, some of these laws are really outdated and they need to be improved given advances in technology. So this is not a complete list of all of the companies that we have given stars to, but I encourage you to take a look at that report so you can get a sense of what the practices of the various companies are. I will tell you that some of the best practices out there are Twitter's, and also a little ISP in Northern California called Sonic.net. How many people are Sonic customers here? Just a few. That's a, I give those guys a lot of credit. So a lot of this is out of your hands because, you know, we're talking about your data stored with other people. But what can you do? So understand what data you're actually disclosing to service providers and that they actually have and maintain. And be selective about the services you use because some of those companies have better practices than others. If it's possible, if you're using a service where you can encrypt data before you upload it, then you should do that. It's best to use a service that lets you encrypt the data yourself and then upload it rather than organizing their designing their services in such a way where they actually might be able to give the government information that would allow decryption of that data. And as I mentioned before, I feel like the legal issues here are tough, and right now the law is not on our side. And so I think this is another area where technical solutions are a good idea. And so keep an eye out for technical solutions and build technical solutions. We're working to do what we can with the law, but those of you who are actually in a position to design good privacy-enhancing protections for data stored by third-party services, that's all good stuff. Okay, so briefly, questioning by law enforcement and other interactions you may have with them. So let's take our scenario before, with the cop coming to the to your house with a warrant. And as the police are searching your home and or seizing your things, they're asking you questions. Who here thinks you have to answer those questions? Yay! You don't have to answer those questions. And in fact, it's best, I think, in your best interest to try to speak to a lawyer before you answer any questions that they ask you. Okay. Let's say you're at a protest, and things are getting a little bit kind of heated and weird, and a policeman comes up to you and starts asking you questions. Who thinks you have to answer those questions? Okay, awesome. That's good. As a general matter, you don't have to answer those questions. There is one little caveat there, which I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about that right now. I gave an early version of this talk a few months ago at NoiseBridge, and people at NoiseBridge are very smart and they have great questions. And one person asked me, well, okay, so you don't have to answer questions, but what if they ask you who you are or ask you for ID? Do you have to answer that question? And here's the deal. There are some states, about half the states out there, have statutes that say that if the police have some suspicion that you're doing something wrong, maybe it's not probable cause, but it's reasonable suspicion, they can ask you who you are and you have to answer. And if you don't, that's against the law. Now, there was a Supreme Court case a few years ago called Heibel versus Nevada. And that case said that if you are in a Terry stop situation, that is, the police already have a reason to believe that you may have done something, but they're not sure, but they think maybe. They can ask you to identify yourself, and that doesn't violate your Fourth Amendment rights. So there are two questions there: A, are you in a state that has that law, and B, are you in a Terry stop situation? And remember, that means that you're being temporarily detained, meaning you're not free to walk away. So how do you know when you're in that situation? I mean, what if you're having a little bit of a moment with a police officer there and he asks you who you are? I mean, how do you know? And what I would suggest is you ask, am I free to go? And if he says no, then you have a Terry stop situation. And if he says yes, then you don't have to answer the question and you can walk away, okay? Another thing, if they are asking you for help, for example, searching your computer or finding things in your home, you don't have to help them. And remember that consent is one of those exceptions to the Fourth Amendment, and so it may very well be in your best interest not to help, even if you feel like you're being impolite or difficult and you're concerned about causing a difficult, awkward interaction, right? Because you wouldn't want your good-natured help to be considered something that it's not. Remember that you can always ask to speak to a lawyer. Maybe they won't always say yes, but you know, if you're having an interaction with the police that you're uncomfortable with, it's never a bad idea. And as a general matter, if they want information from you, it is a good idea, I think, to speak to a lawyer first, because as we all know, anything you say can be used against you, and if you don't give them information, then they can't. So maybe this is a little bit, I'm very big on etiquette, and my mother was as well, and so I always feel a little bit silly when I talk about this, because I'm just kind of, I have a thing about politeness, but really, seriously, in situations like this, I think it's never a bad thing to be polite. I think these situations can often become very awkward, and you feel strange being uncooperative because it feels confrontational and like you're only gonna escalate things and make everything worse. But remember, it's not in your best interest to be helpful, and it's not in your best interest to offer information. And I think that often police officers can try to use that against you, you know, try to, you know, make you feel like you're being awkward, you know, rude and uncooperative so that you feel like you need to change the way you're acting. So I think that to help kind of keep things, you know, kind of calm and copacetic, you know, just be polite. I mean, you know, you're not going to help them, but you don't have to be antagonistic, you know. There are some things that are some very bad ideas if you do them. And, you know, I'm not giving legal advice here, but I'm just saying there are some things that are bad ideas. One is lying to the police. It is a very bad idea to lie. That is a separate and distinct crime. And if you lie, it may give them grounds to pursue something against you that they didn't have before. And so never lie either affirmatively or by omission. I think that is important. It's a bad idea to interfere with a search. If they come into your home and they are searching your things, if they are searching, you know, if you look at that warrant and it doesn't have computers in it and they're searching your computer or they're taking your computer, don't try to wrestle it away from them, or, you know, just let them do it and then talk to your lawyer about it. It is very important not to destroy, delete, or alter anything that might frustrate an investigation. And Hanny gave a whole talk on this yesterday. He's done a lot of research on this, and if you have questions about this, he's a great person to talk to. Okay, so compelled disclosure of passwords and encryption passphrases and encrypted information. I'm actually giving a whole talk on this at DEF CON in a couple of weeks, and so I'm not going to get into it a whole lot, but I think that it is a good thing to discuss. So the Fifth Amendment gives you the right to not incriminate yourself. No person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. So the privilege against self-incrimination protects against government attempts to, you know, force you to give testimonial evidence that would tend to incriminate you. Now, I think it's easy to grasp the concept of what is compelled. It's when they force you. It's when you don't have a choice, right? If they walk into your house and you know they want to like log on to your computer and they're saying, "Oh, hey, would you give me your encryption passphrase?" Do you have to give it to them? Who thinks you have to give it to them? Excellent. The only time you can be forced to give information in a situation like this is by a judge, okay? And only if you don't have a valid privilege against self-incrimination. So keep that in mind when we talk about compulsion. Excuse me? I'm getting to that. Okay, so the next part is testimonial evidence. What is testimonial versus non-testimonial? Okay, testimonial evidence is when you reveal the contents of your mind, okay, as opposed to like some physical tangible thing. So a good way to think about this is a combination lock versus a key. And this is actually a comparison that the Supreme Court has put out there. So if the police wanted to unlock a safe, and the safe had a combination lock, and the only way they could get the combination is by making you say it, then that implicates the privilege against self-incrimination, because you would have to be telling them something that reveals the contents of your mind, all right? Now, if there is a key to that safe, and they say, give us the key to that safe, if you have the key, the Fifth Amendment doesn't protect you from having to turn it over, because it is a physical thing. It doesn't reveal anything about your mind that would give them evidence against you, okay? Does that make sense? Well, and we're going to talk a little bit about that too. Okay, one thing that's important to realize, and this is something that gets a little bit difficult to figure out, the privilege of self-incrimination can apply to an act of production, giving something over, if it has testimonial aspects, meaning if you give it to them, it would tend to confirm the existence of something, or that you possess it, or that you control it, or that it's authentic, all right? And I think that's where this becomes important when we talk about attempts to force you to turn over passwords and encrypted data, because if you are first, this is stuff that already exists, right? But if you are forced to turn over a password or a passphrase, or you're forced to decrypt it, what you're basically showing is that you have control over it, right? And that can be very important and incriminating in a case. Something that I think a lot of people don't know, but it's important to realize, is that the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination is something that's very personal to you and your situation. It can only be invoked by the person who actually has the right. So if you know something about a friend that might be incriminating, you can't invoke the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination to protect your friend, okay? It only lies with you. Now, I realize I actually made a mistake in the next slide, I believe. Oh, no, I didn't. Okay. One thing that I did not put in my slides, but is important also, is what the concept of incrimination is. Now, if something is incriminating, what that means is that it might give the government the information that it would need to try to prosecute you for something. It doesn't mean that you're actually guilty, okay? The Fifth Amendment is something, the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination is something that protects the innocent as well as the guilty, and that's something the Supreme Court has said. What the Fifth Amendment protects is it protects you against adverse police action based on being ensnared in ambiguous circumstances. That is actually the Supreme Court's phrase, ensnared in ambiguous circumstances. So you might be a totally innocent person in a situation that looks bad, and you have a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. And you know, the privilege is basically intended to protect you from being in this odd, awkward position where your only options are basically to give up information that might be against your interest, that might be used to bring charges against you, either rightfully or wrongfully, or lie to the police, or say, I can't give you that information, and being thrown in jail. That's why we have the privilege against self-incrimination, is because we don't want people to be in that situation. We think it's unfair. There are a couple of important exceptions. The first is foregone conclusion. If the cops already have a pretty good idea that there is evidence in your possession, and what it is and where they're going to find it, the privilege might not apply, because the important factor is the difference between what you know and what they know. And if basically you wouldn't be telling them anything they don't already know, then there's no privilege to protect, basically, and you may still have to turn the stuff over. The other thing is immunity. The government can overcome a privilege that you have by giving you immunity from prosecution based on that production of information or anything they would learn as a result of having that information or anything they would discover as a result of having that information. And the reason why that is because if there's no longer a possibility that you could incriminate yourself because they're not going to bring charges against you, then the privilege doesn't apply, okay? But the important thing is that whatever immunity they offer has to be just as broad as the privilege, or else it's just not good enough and you still have a privilege. There have been some important cases along these lines, and they've really just come up in the past few years. I'm not going to talk about them in detail. I'm going to go through them in excruciating detail at DEF CON, if you want to come to that talk. But basically, the rule that kind of emerges from these cases, I would say, is that the courts seem to believe that you have a valid Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination that, you know, protects you against having to disclose your password if it would tend to incriminate you. It can be a tougher call if it is a situation where they just want you to produce a decrypted version of encrypted data. But, you know, basically, if they already have a good sense that there's something incriminating on your computer and turning it over wouldn't tell them anything they don't already know, then foregone conclusion and the privilege doesn't apply. But if they're trying to force you to decrypt data and it would tell them something they don't already know, it would reveal the existence of evidence that they don't know about, if it would reveal that you have a certain amount of control over something that they didn't know you had control over, then you may very well have a Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, all right? So, okay, what can you do? Choose strong passphrases that you can remember, so they're in your brain. I use a password manager. How many people here use password managers? Okay. I think that this is a good option because you can have strong passwords, and while it is true they are recorded, you have to have a password to access them. And if you remember that password, I think that that is a good situation. If you are asked to turn over a password, consider exercising your right to remain silent. Consult a lawyer about that. And, you know, remember, only a judge can force you to turn it over, so it might be best to err on the side of refusing to disclose information and let your lawyer deal with it. Choosing a strong passphrase, I don't know how well you can see this, XKCD, good advice on choosing a strong password. If you want to come back and look at this, you want a password with high entropy, but something that's easy for you to remember and difficult for other people to guess. You know, he basically suggests choosing four random common words and having a mnemonic device so that it means something to you, but it doesn't mean anything to anybody else. Okay, further reading, we have a white paper, Know Your Rights. We have tips for talking to the police, which you can get at the EFF vendor booth. And that's it. And I got questions for whoever wants them. And 1 second before we start. Remember, if you have a personal situation that you'd like to talk about, don't bring it up here. Come talk to us privately. And I know that probably we're not going to have enough time to take everybody's questions, so come talk to me and or Hanny later, okay?
Hello. Thank you. We're in full talk. I was wondering about these little USB drives and some hypothetical situations. What's a better position to be in? The USB drive is in your computer desk and your house gets searched. You have it on your person. You get searched. Or you're running away from cops, then it gets lost in the woods.
Oh, my gosh. I guess if the question is what puts you in the best position legally,
yes.
I would say that if you have it in your desk drawer, they're probably going to need a warrant to get it. If you have it on your person and you're in a situation where you get arrested or something, I think it depends on the jurisdiction. You know, they may say, well, we seized it incident to arrest. We don't need a warrant. Some other court might say that they do need a warrant. If you throw it away, my concern is that if they find it, it looks like maybe you tried to get rid of evidence, and that probably isn't very good for you. That's my take on that.
And I was wondering about third-party information disclosures. Has there been any case law about VPS providers, because they're like virtual imaginary computer systems, but you're in complete control, although the hardware belongs to someone else?
I'm not aware of any cases on that yet.
All right, thank you.
The law is slow. Like I said before, it takes a long time to catch up. Okay. I've been asked to remind you that we have a table downstairs, and you can, you know, meet with us down there. We're happy to talk with you. Do I have time for a couple more questions? Okay.
You mentioned you need reasonable suspicion at airports for them to actually search your body.
So not like the outside of your person, but it's like
insides.
If they think that, yeah.
So how do the full body scanners play into that at all, and if they do?
Yeah, that is kind of a difficult question. You know, I think the reason that the courts have said, and the Supreme Court has said that, you know, if they suspect you're smuggling drugs or something, they need reasonable suspicion to, you know, search the interior of your body, is because that is such an invasive thing, all right? Like, physically invasive. And I don't think anybody disputes that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in, you know, your alimentary canal, all right? And I think that the idea is that, you know, the full body scanners don't involve any physical intrusion. And I'm aware of one court who's, you know, considered the Fourth Amendment implications and said that under the Fourth Amendment, it's kosher. And I suspect that if it was a more physically invasive procedure, that case might not have gone that way. That's my take on that.
Hi. I wanted to go back to search engine incident to arrest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not well read on the issue, but I know that, and I read the Seventh Circuit opinion, where basically Judge Posner upheld search of a cell phone data, incident to arrest. And his rationales were not convincing to me at all. I know,
mm-hmm,
I'm a little biased. But I'm curious, playing devil's advocate, what are the best arguments you've heard in support of that search? Because typically I thought they were supposed to be based on officer safety and preservation of evidence.
The best arguments in favor of the idea that the police ought to be able to search an incident to arrest?
Correct, yeah.
I think the best arguments that I've heard the government offer up is the idea that you might remotely wipe your phone. And if they take the time to get a warrant, the evidence might disappear. And, you know, our response to that has been that, you know, a sound forensic practice would be to, you know, put that phone in a Faraday bag of some sort and, you know, basically get a warrant and then search it. Because if you don't do that, I mean, you may end up tainting your evidence anyway. So, I mean, if you have a situation where a policeman is just rifling through a phone, that's probably not a good situation from a forensics perspective. So, yeah, I would say that's probably the best argument.
Okay, thank you.
Could you go over a few of the main differences between a criminal investigation versus like a civil lawsuit, like discovery law? That would,
you know, discovery?
Yeah, like so instead of when, you know, they're searching your house, but when you're in the discovery process and you're being asked questions and, you know, you're having to give up information voluntarily.
I think that could be a very long and involved answer. Why don't we talk about that a little later, if that's okay?
Great talk.
Thank you.
You said financial info is always privileged. So if I upload a copy of like QuickBooks to my Dropbox, would that prevent them from revealing any of my data?
So I'm sorry. I did not mean to suggest that financial data is always privileged. What I meant to say, my point was that there are different laws that protect privacy of financial data in certain circumstances, like when it's held by financial institutions. And I wasn't sure how those laws interact with ECPA, with the communications privacy laws. I don't think it is sort of universally true that financial data gets, you know, like a special like financial privilege or something like that. But what I would say is that, you know, if you have data that you encrypt that is uploaded to a service like, well, to a third-party storage service, and you are the only one who's in a position to decrypt that information, I think that you're in a pretty good position legally, because, you know, they're going to have a hard time getting access to that data with a like low-level process, because, you know, you would have to be in a position to have to decrypt it, right? So we'd be talking about Fifth Amendment stuff at that point. That's it. Okay, sorry, I'm done. Thank you, guys.
If you have any more questions for EFF, they have a table downstairs, and there's a fine bank of attorneys willing to speak to you. Thank you.
No, I'm not actually going to be online.
Okay.
I do need to test audio, and then I need to do video
awesome.
At that point. So who's going to give me the thumbs up on the audio?
Say that again?
Who is going to give me the thumbs up on the audio level?
Right there. The guy,
got
see that wedge shape?
Yeah,
the guy standing there.
Okay, but he's not there, right?
I think so.
He will be.
The guy
okay.
in the hat.
Yeah. The guy in the hat. Got it.
Hat.
Thank you. We'll be right back. life seemingly living in the 1960s and 1970s, reading old memos where things were sent by teletype. But so what I'd like to do today is tell you a little bit, just for those of you who were not present for the 1960s and 1970s, tell you a little bit of the background about phone phreaking. I'd then like to describe some of my Freedom of Information Act travails and experiences and fun things. And then I'm going to go off the record and tell you all the stuff that's not in the book, and then conclude with a few lessons learned. And the lessons learned are not just for those of you writing history books, which I can tell you is not a particularly lucrative or good way to spend your time, but it's for any big creative project, but especially anyone that has kind of any sort of historical bent to it. And for any of you who may be worried, I just want to stress that all information contained herein is unclassified, at least according to FBI Declassification Guy 60324, who sounds like he should be working for the Department of Homeland Security with a name like that. So here's the background briefing on phone phreaking. And remember my FBI memo fetish. This is beautiful. So when the FBI sends you something under the Freedom of Information Act, they scan it in, and then they often now send it to you electronically. And their scanner has this amazing way of taking old black and white photographs and making them look just so cool. But admire this for just a moment. Imagine a world where a telephone receiver ends up with an FBI evidence tag on it, right? I mean, how does that happen? And it turns out there are several reasons how that happens. And the first one starts here. Now, if you are a normal person, you look at that and you think, oh, well, you know, it's an old rotary phone, whatever. It's a phone, right? It's not that interesting. It's not something that you spend any time thinking about. It is, in the words of phone freak Evan Dorbell, it is not something that is interesting enough to be interested in at all. If you are in this audience, I posit that you are not a normal person. Yeah. And so, to me, this represents not a black rotary phone, but it represents curiosity personified. Because if you have a certain mental defect, like many of us do, you look at something like that and you say, wow, I wonder how that works. I wonder where it goes to. I wonder what happens if you take it apart. I wonder what happens if you use it in ways that it was not intended to be used. I wonder what happens if you dial numbers that are not in the phone book. I wonder what happens if you play with it. Where do those wires go? How does that all work? In addition, if that's not enough, they made it more tantalizing, because in the old days, if you placed a call, a long-distance call, you'd hear something like this. Can we maybe up the volume on that just a smidge, please? So let me ask a show of hands. How many people have placed a long-distance call and heard something like that, right? Okay, so a chunk of you. That says you're of a certain age. But, you know, you place that call, and again, you know, in the words of Bill Murray, there's something wrong with us, something very, very wrong with us. You hear those tones, and you think, what are those? What, it's talking to something. There are these tones. What are they? How does it work? And so you get this curiosity. And so starting around, you know, the 1950s, 1960s, you start to get people who want to play with the phone. They're curious about it. They want to understand how it works. They want to take it apart. They want to hack with it. Now, so one thing that causes a telephone receiver to have an FBI evidence tag on it is curiosity. There's another thing which plays into this, which is economics. If you go back to the 1900s, 1890s, when the phone starts, you don't have telephones with dials, you just have telephones. You pick up the phone, and the operator says, number, please. The operator initially was teenage boys, but they figured out pretty quickly that didn't work. So they replace them with female operators who were more pleasant. But, you know, initially it's number, please, but then eventually you have phones with dials and you can dial, but you still can't dial long distance. And even by the 1950s, 1960s, you know, 70% of long distance calls were still placed through an operator on a cord board. You know, she selects a jack and maybe she has a little keypad, which was not arranged in a 3x4 thing, was two by five for sending MF tones to the machines. But anyway, someone like this places your calls. Now, the phone company, sorry, I get them confused sometimes. The phone company, you know, pretty smart bunch of people, and they can see the handwriting on the wall. Telephone service is becoming more and more popular. And they look at something like this, and from the 1930s to about the 1950s, 1960s, they employed about 100,000 telephone operators. Now, think about that. That's a pretty staggering number. 100,000 people as telephone operators. Initially, they started off doing local calls, but then as local calls get automated, they switch over to long distance. Now, that's fine for 100,000 people, but even by the 1950s, they had figured out that, gosh, you know, at the current rate of growth, by 1965, 1970, we're going to need 1 million telephone operators. And there are two problems with that. Problem number one is we can't afford it. Paying 1 million people is just going to bankrupt us. Problem number two is it turns out there simply aren't that many women in the workforce, right? I mean, imagine that you're like the national HR director of AT&T and you've got your envelope out in the restaurant, you're doing the back of the thing, blah, 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 1 million. That doesn't work, right? They just can't do it. So the answer is automation. So this is a photo from the AT&T archives of what was called a 4A toll crossbar, 4A toll machine. Take a look at that for just a second and get the scale. It's not a great photo, but that is a man standing there. Notice that the machine is much, much larger. Then realize that this is only a portion of the machine. This machine, which was, you know, we're not talking transistors, right? This thing was first built in 1943. We're talking electromechanical switches. We're talking relays. We're talking vacuum tubes. This thing took up the better part of a city block, okay? AT&T ended up installing hundreds of these things around the country, and this was the magic switching machine that could figure out how to automatically route a call from point A to point B. It could talk to other switching machines. It was the thing which was going to make long-distance operators obsolete. Now, I still just remain stunned by that because that is such a tall order, right? Imagine building a machine that knows how to route a call from point A to point B, except you don't have a computer, and in fact, the transistor hasn't even been invented yet, right? This is a tall order, and yet AT&T actually did this. So you've got these machines, but now, in the old days, when the operators wanted to communicate with one another, they'd plug into the jack, and they'd, you know, dial the next city closer to your destination, and, you know, the operator there would say, you know, Denver inward, and you'd say, Denver, this is Chicago, I need to place a call to this number, and the call would move downfield very manually with operators talking to one another. Now with the machines have to talk to each other. How are they going to do that? Well, it turns out they're going to do it by tones. And so the entire network was controlled by tones. That was how the machines communicated. There was a 2600 hertz tone, which controlled whether a phone call was on or off hook. And then there were these MF tones, kind of like touch tones, the MF tones that we heard before, the ones that we were so curious about. And that's what allows the machines to communicate. The only problem is if the machines can hear and can make and hear these tones, then so can clever human beings. And so it's not very long before you have people making these boxes. The one on the left was a so-called single-frequency box. It was made in 1961 by a college student up in the Pacific Northwest. And as you rotated that dial there, it would just make beep, 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 you know, whatever number you dialed. And that was the old signaling system. Later, they had a more sophisticated signaling system. So the one on the right is a multi-frequency box, which made those quick little tones that we heard before. Like touch tones, but different frequencies. So with this, you could make a free phone call. Did I just hear 2600 hertz someplace? Did somebody just beep? I thought I did. With this, you could make a free phone call, but that's actually almost not the point. Because for the kids of this generation, for the 1960s, yeah, okay, sure. I've talked to so many of these phone freaks, and they would tell me, we're 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old kids. We don't have anybody to call, right? We don't know anybody. The only thing we want to do is we want to call, you know, we want to call non-working test numbers. We want to see how close we can get to the North Pole. We want to, you know, we just want to see how the network works. We're just curious, right? So, that's really that's the impetus for this. If you are a teenage phone freak in the 1960s or 1970s, you want to play with the network. Not to say that you never made free calls, because you want to talk to your friends, of course, once you discover them, but that's the main reason. Now, there's another set of people who like this, and there are people like this. This is a bookmaker in the 1940s, and it turns out pre-internet, 1940s, if you wanted to keep in touch with your customers and if you wanted to know, you know, what the betting line was from Las Vegas and Atlantic City on a sporting event, you were constantly on the phone, as evidenced by this photo here. And that was two problems for you if you're a bookmaker. Problem number one is it's really expensive because AT&T's rates were expensive back in the day for long distance. Problem number two is that the pesky FBI is constantly looking at your toll records. We just had that talk by the EFF attorney. So the FBI had figured out, well, we can't really necessarily wiretap these guys. At the time, it wasn't necessarily legal. But we can certainly subpoena their toll records and figure out who this guy calls and build a network map. And so the organized crime and bookmakers were particularly interested in using blue boxes and black boxes to defeat the telephone company's carefully designed billing system so that there weren't any records anymore of the phone calls that they had made. So you've got two different users groups here, if you will, right? You've got the phone freak users group and you've got the organized crime users group. The phone freak started off as people working alone in isolation. But around 1969, 1970, they start to meet one another. And it's kind of through a series of really random kind of connections. And so this is John Draper, Captain Crunch, one of the more notorious phone freaks in this era. But there were others, Joe Ingresia, a.k.a. Joy Bubbles, the blind whistling phone freak, Bill from New York, a whole bunch of them there. And they started meeting each other through anonymous loop-around circuits, through introductions from one another. And pretty soon, you've got, by 1969, 1970, you've got this whole underground community that's starting to talk to each other. And, you know, as many of them told me, they're like, this is the greatest thing in the world. Because up until now, it's just been me and the phone. And whenever I talk to somebody about it, they're like, ah, stupid phone, whatever. Who cares? What a dumb hobby. Now I've finally met somebody that actually gets this. Not just somebody, but multiple people. This is an amazing thing if you're a 16-year-old kid and you're kind of lonely and you have an odd hobby. Then Ron Rosenbaum comes along in 1971 and writes an Esquire magazine article about it called Secrets of the Little Blue Box. Esquire has a circulation of 500,000 people, and this underground hobby just gets blown out to the entire world. Right now, everybody knows about this. The article reads like fiction, but if you're a certain kind of a person, say you're a Steve Wozniak, and you read this, you look at it, and you're like, this isn't fiction. This isn't fiction. This has got to be real, and I've got to figure this stuff out. By the way, this is something that never ceases to amaze me. Any phone freak who learned about phone freaking from the Esquire article can describe the Esquire article on page 116, which begins with a photo of a blue box. They can describe it to me in detail. They say, oh my God, it was great, really well-written article. It's got this fantastic box. It's a plastic box. It's got 13 buttons on it, 12 in front, aluminum frame. None of them remember the cover of the magazine. Not one. So the other thing that happens in 1971 is the Yippies get a hold of this. And so this is the Youth International Party Line. This is their first newsletter. It's an offshoot of the Youth International Party. And unlike the phone hackers, being interested in just experimenting and playing with the telephone network, the Yippies had a very specific political purpose for this, which is this is the way to stick it to the man. And in particular, not just the phone company, who they didn't like, but the United States government. Well, why is that? Well, there was something called the telephone excise tax. Now, this is a 10% tax on long-distance phone calls. And that was used to pay, and it raked in like, you know, $1 billion, $1.5 billion in 1970 or so. It's significant money. That's about 10% of the cost of the Vietnam War. So the great news is, if you can figure out how to make free phone calls, not only you get free phone calls, but you're screwing the government and preventing, you know, the government from sending people off to fight and die in Southeast Asia. What a great thing, right? So, you know, this is the start kind of the cultural hijacking of what was this little geeky hobby of exploring the telephone network. And now you've got people who just want to make free phone calls. You've got the Yippies who are getting involved. You get all this stuff. Now, the next thing that comes out is in 1975, you find out that the phone company had not been sitting idly by during this time. They heard in 1961, that's when they first discovered a blue box, and in 1964 to 1970, they had built a toll fraud surveillance network, right? Now, they couldn't use their normal billing system because that's what the blue box defeats, so they built a separate thing. These were six machines deployed all over the cities of the United States. They moved them around from time to time. It randomly monitored phone calls looking for evidence of fraud, like 2600 hertz on a line when it shouldn't be there. And when it found it, it would take an audacious next step. It would actually tape record the call onto reel-to-reel tape. They randomly monitored, during that time, 33 million phone calls and tape recorded and listened to them by ear, 1.5 million of them, all to get an understanding of how big is this problem? Are we totally screwed or are we only just a little bit screwed, right? Because you need statistics like that if you're going to make any sort of decision about maybe having to spend $1 billion to upgrade your network to get rid of this fraud problem. So that came out in 1975, when the St. Louis Post-Dispatch happened to get an expose on it. I'm skipping over a whole bunch of history here, but I just wanted to give you the background on that. So that's phone freaking in a nutshell during its analog heyday. When I started writing this book in 2006, I was immediately contacted by several modern-day phone freaks who said, whatever you do, do not tell people that phone freaking is dead. And so I hereby tell you phone freaking is not dead. But that's the 1960-1970 version of it. So now I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the Freedom of Information Act. But before I do, I want us to ogle this very fine FBI evidence photo. An ever-ready energizer transistor or vacuum tube battery. This is not a small battery, my friends, which is evidence, right? So isn't that awesome? So in the process of writing this book, I ended up relying heavily on the Freedom of Information Act in addition to interviews. I filed over 400 Freedom of Information Act requests, and I got about 100 of them were successful, meaning at 300 of them I got back basically, you know, go away, boy, you bother us. We don't have any records like that. I spammed virtually every federal agency I could think of, you know, FBI, Department of Justice, the National Security Agency, the CIA, the Air Force, the Navy, the Army. I looked, the Federal Agency for the Management of Noxious Weeds, I did not send anything to, and that is a real agency. Some of the response, the fastest ones I got back were maybe in 3 months. In the case of the National Security Agency, it took 3 years to get a response back. I do not recommend this unless you are working on a five-year PhD or five-year book kind of project. If you need something next week, this is not going to help you. This is the memo here, not that you can read it, but just it gives you a sense of what this is like. You get stuff back from the government, and they're allowed to redact pieces out. And along the right-hand side of that memo, you'll see these little codes. But the codes describe which parts of the memo are blacked out. And so very frequently you get names that are blacked out under, there's an exemption called B6 or B7C, which has to do with personal privacy. So I spent a lot of time looking at, I got, you know, 10,000 pages of documents that I spent studying like this, trying to figure out, well, who's in that blacked out space? Huh, that blacked out space looks like it's 4 characters long. I know a phone freak who has a 4-character last name. Maybe. So I spent a lot of time puzzling over this and developed a number of different techniques for getting more information, for data mining out of paper, if you will. One of which was, if you request the same file by multiple methods, it may turn out that multiple people at the FBI or whoever actually process it, and different people, being human beings, redact different things, and then you can lay the papers on top of each other and see what else is there. The other thing I found, and the EFF person who spoke before me said, you want to be polite to people, right? And I worked really hard to not come off as a total nut job, right? Which, in fact, I am. So I would spend time talking to the FBI clerks who were processing these things, and I would explain to them that, you know, this is what I'm doing, and it's a very legitimate historical thing, and I tried to be very, very nice to them, and I think that worked. It got to the point where I may have taken things a little bit far. I started sending them holiday cards. This is a holiday card I sent to the FBI and the NSA in 2008. And, it may not have actually gotten me any additional documents, but it did get me a couple good stories, one of which was at one point I had requested some file having to do with the San Francisco FBI office and wiretapping. And the FBI FOIA person basically sent me a letter saying, no, I we can't send that to you. And so I ended up calling and talking to her on the phone. And we had a very nice chat. And she said, well, you know, when I wrote up the denial letter, I took the denial letter to my supervisor and I handed it to her to approve. And my supervisor took one look at it and said, oh, you're not going to send Mr. Lapsley this, are you? And she said, well, I think I have to. I don't actually think he's entitled to this information under FOIA. And she signed it and handed it back to me and said, well, you're not going to get a Christmas card this year. So you catch more flies with honey, maybe. Okay, so some of the things that I've got from FOIA, and you may have seen some of these before. Joy Bubble, Joe Ingresia, the blind whistling phone freak, he was arrested in 1971, I think, in Memphis. But it turns out prior to that, he had been investigated by the FBI in 1969. And you can't quite read all of this, but what's stunning about this is a letter sent by the FBI after they determined that he might, and they weren't even sure that he had, but he might have been listening to both the military Audubon phone system breaking into it and also the White House system. And so what it says here, this is actually a letter to the Honorable John D. Ehrlichman, counsel to the president from the FBI. And, you know, one of the questions I was trying to figure out when I wrote my book is, well, how seriously did the federal government and the FBI take phone freaking, right? Well, apparently seriously enough to send a letter to President Nixon saying, hey, we think this blind guy who can whistle broke into the White House phone system, but we're not really sure. Here's another one. This is from the director of the FBI, Clarence Kelly. And it is to Mr. John D. DeButz, who's the chairman of the board of AT&T. This is in 1976, and it was when, several years before 1976, in the early 70s, the phone freaks had figured out in some parts of the country you could use a blue box to wiretap phone calls. And in 1975, John Draper used his blue box to wiretap the FBI's San Francisco field office. And then he bragged about it to somebody who was an informant for the FBI, and that didn't end well for him. But it, yes, John, are you here? There's John. Give him a hand. So, but it, you know, it generates this letter, which I'll see if I can read and talk into the microphone at the same time. I am advised, can you hear me on that? I am advised that information just developed and confirmed discloses a condition which permits any knowledgeable person using a blue box to intercept and monitor telephone conversations to and from the San Francisco FBI office and other subscribers in that area. This is a most alarming situation, and I request the full cooperation of your organization and its resources to assess the possibility for similar conditions elsewhere and take immediate corrective action wherever they exist. So, you know, the... John, you managed to piss off the director of the FBI, and that's work. All right. Then this is another thing. These were formerly classified secret. This was my three-year NSA request. And it's a series. So if you know about the NSA, they've got the code-breaking portion of the house, right, which is concerned with communications intelligence, breaking other people's code, and they've got the code making and communication security or ComSec side of the house. So it turned out in 1976, because of various things that the phone freaks were up to, including starting to break into computers in the very early days and also breaking the military Audubon phone system and also wiretapping the FBI, the NSA ComSec people got involved in this. And so this is a pair of memos. One of them is titled Phone Freaks Invade Audubon, and the other is titled Phone Freaks Invade Computer Networks. This is written by the ComSec guys. One of the lines I love out of this, certain elements of the phone freak community have expanded their activities to include accessing computer systems, including, drumroll please, those systems, including those accessed by teletypewriters and cathode ray tubes. One phone freak stated that he had accessed the Advanced Research Projects Agency ARPA network. Once there, he could access other computers, including the NSA. So, you know, so it's just interesting to see how the government, you know, dealt with this stuff and how seriously they took it. Now, the final thing is, when you're going through 10,000 pages of FBI documents, you know, you kiss a lot of toads, right? There's an awful lot of pages that are like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And because a lot of my stuff involved organized crime, I spent a lot of time reading organized crime files, much of which had nothing to do with phone freaking. But occasionally you get these things that just sort of make it worthwhile. This, I just remember flipping through a file and then suddenly coming upon this. This is in some random organized crime guy's file. And what I love about this in particular is the fact that the woman's face is blacked out with a B6 and B7C in the corner because of personal privacy, right? The FBI takes their job very seriously. They'll give me the photo, just not the face. So that's the Freedom of Information Act. So now I'd like to tell you a few off-the-record stories. Again, after we first ogle an FBI evidence photo. I'm not even really sure what that is. I'm not sure what it's evidence of, but something bad, no doubt. I'd like to first introduce you to a fellow named Ken Hopper. And Ken was a longtime employee of the Bell system. He worked for both Bell Pennsylvania and Bell Laboratories. He was the head at one point of their telephone crime lab. He worked in their special systems group, which did government projects. He was involved in all this stuff, and he was a tremendous resource to me. He made many introductions on my behalf. He was also a pack rat, as you can see here. This was in 2006. He was 80 years old. Unfortunately, he passed away from cancer about a year later. But, you know, proof of just how helpful pack rats are to historians, which is a theme which came up over and over again during this book, of just, you know, there's nothing like actual copies of papers or whatever from the day. By the way, for those of you who are hams, he was a ham, KD7KH. But the thing that he said to me, don't put this in your book, but anybody recognize this? I heard submarine. So back in the 1970s, the United States intercepted a bunch of Soviet undersea cables. It was a thing called Operation Ivy Bells. And if you're going to want help with somebody who, if you want help from somebody building a undersea cable tapping system, well, you turn to Bell Labs and the Government Systems Group. And so U.S. submarines placed this thing on the floor of the sea outside of just off the coast of Russia, and it was an inductive tap probe, self-powered, you know, frogmen get out of the submarine and put it there and hook it up to the cable. And eventually, the Soviets found out about this. It apparently produced a lot of great intelligence for us for several years. There's a book called Blind Man's Bluff, which you should read. It's really fascinating about the submarine espionage program. But this wound up on display in a museum in Moscow, and they talked about the fact that it actually has a thumb in the eye to the Soviets, because once you open this thing up, there's a sign inside that says, Property of United States Government. And so they talked about how this was, you know, a thumb in the eye to the Soviets and blah, blah, blah. And Ken told me, don't put this in your book, so I guess I'm telling it to you. He said, don't put this in your book, but that wasn't a thumb in the eye to the Soviets. I said, well, what was it, Ken? Well, we had this in the yard at Holmdel. We had this big thing set up there. For all I know, this photo may be from Bell Labs Holmdel. And he said, you know, accountants are a real problem. And so some accountant decided that, well, this is Bell Labs property. And so they went and put it on the Bell Labs property book. And he said, it took me months of fighting with the bureaucracy to get this fixed, right? You know how it is with accountants. It's on the property. Oh, no, we can't do that. So eventually he managed to get it off and transferred back to its rightful owner, which was the United States government. And he said, and I vowed at that point, that's never going to happen again. That was 2 months of my life I can't afford. So I went and put a sign on it that said, Property of United States Government. So there's one, don't put this in your book. The next thing I'd like to bring back to this blue box here on the left. This is from a phone freak we'll call JT. He was a phone freak in 1964. He was a student at Rice University. And he learned about phone freaking from this AT&T book called Principles of Electricity Applied to Telephone and Telegraph Work. He's a smart guy, an engineer. And I'm going to let him, in his own words, tell you a little bit about how he came to build and test this blue box in 1964, 1965.
Both of my grandfathers were engineers. My father and all of my uncles were engineers or the equivalent. My children are engineers. So gravitating, I don't know whether that's the right word for
it. Maybe you were just there to begin with.
Or it's genetic. My mother believes it's a recessive trait. So it just all of a sudden occurred to me that I knew how it worked. And, well, what do you do about it when you think you know how something works? Well, all of us have been schooled in the scientific method. It's just really straightforward. The scientific method is you have a theory for something.
Yep.
And, you know, you are just obligated to test it.
That's right.
I mean, there's just no choice but to go test it. So, what do? You have to test it.
Yep.
Well, testing it meant building something. Okay? And so I sat down and I designed up something. And I decided not to just stop with push buttons, turning on pairs of tones. I decided to build something that incorporated all of the knowledge I had, and that turned into something that is sort of funny now. It was going to cost me $50. Okay, now $50 now back in 1964, 65 was actually kind of a lot of money.
Sure.
You know, go figure the consumer price index.
Yep.
You know, and I bet you'll find it's well in excess of $500 now.
Mm-hmm.
So is it really worth spending $500? the answer is yeah. So anyway, I spent all of Christmas break building the thing. And I took it back to Rice with me. By the way, the girl was just totally furious. I ignored her for the whole 2 weeks except for I took her to Dr. Zhivago. And I still remember there's a scene in Dr. Zhivago where they're on a sleigh going out into the middle of the steppes. And it's just cold, 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 cold. And I remember thinking that that didn't look nearly as cold as the woman sitting next to me felt about my having ignored her so thoroughly.
So that is the dedication that a phone freak has. So he went on to build this blue box after ignoring his girlfriend for 2 weeks, and went on to use it and play with it and test it out. And the hacker historian and filmmaker Jason Scott read a draft of my book at one point, and he said, "You know, Phil," he said, there's sort of an archetypal theme or story that comes through your book." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, it starts off with a teenager, a curious teenager, thinking, wow, I wonder what if we did this? I mean, I wonder how this works. Maybe we should test this." And it ends up with that same teenager in a room with multiple adults yelling at him. And so sure enough, that was, in fact, exactly this story. And so JT, the phone freak here, in 1965, got a visit from Southwestern Bell Security, John Fry. And what was very interesting is he was interviewed, slapped on the wrist, and Special Agent Fry sent him a card, not signed, that said, "Thanks very much. I enjoyed your explanation and your interest in the communications industry." He actually got to keep his blue box. JT, by the way, now works, he's actually the head of a communications company, which, as he puts it, designs halves of communication systems. That is to say, the receive half. He builds eavesdropping equipment for the National Security Agency and other United States government things. So he, you know, it's just a straight line for him, and it's the same thing. And I think he's very good at it. So the final thing I'd like to tell you about is a story about the International Society of Telephone Enthusiasts and a mysterious fellow named B. David, whom I've never met. When one of my first stories, when I was interviewing, it's one of the first people I interviewed, talked about answering a mysterious ad in the Harvard Crimson newspaper. It was signed by B. David in St. Louis, Missouri, and it was an ad that was almost nonsensical. And it's a fun story. I won't give it to you now, but he started corresponding with B. David, and it turned out B. David was the mysterious head of this organization, which I think consisted of B. David. The International Society of Telephone Enthusiasts. And B. David loved paranoia and spy stuff. And he just kept popping up, and I kept trying to find him for my book. I wanted to talk to him, and I would talk to various phone freaks. "No, you know, I don't know a B. David. Oh, I knew a guy who maybe fits that kind of paranoid, kind of, yeah, no, that's that guy, but no, he's not going to talk to you." And so for several years, you know, I kept trying to make overtures to B. David, never got anywhere. And then one day, Saturday morning, 6 a.m., my phone rings, and rings, and rings. And I'm in bed, and I say, "Well, I'm not going to answer it. It's 6 a.m. This is crazy." Well, it turns out B. David can outlast me, because the phone rang for 10 minutes. So I get up, and I go down the hall, and I pick up the phone. I say, "Hello." And he's like, "Hi, Phil, this is B. David. I'd like to talk to you about your book." I'm like, "Well, you know, now's not really a great time. I'm kind of asleep right now. Could I call you back?" "No, I'm very busy. I'd like to talk to you now if you'd like to talk. Otherwise, we don't have to talk." "Oh, okay, I guess we'll talk now then." He said, "Well, before we talk, there are three things that we have to get straight. There are three rules." And I said, "Okay, what are those rules?" He said, "Well, rule number one is you can't mention my real name." I said, "Okay, that's fine. I do that in my book. That's no problem." He said, "Rule number two is I get to review anything you write about me." I said, "Okay, well, you know, we can talk about that. I'm not thrilled with that, but I can live with that. Rule number three is I get 10% of the royalties on your book." And I said, "Well, you know, I don't think I can agree to that, B. David." He said, "Well, think about it. Just think about it for a while." I said, "Well, I've thought about it." "No." And he said, "Well, we have nothing further to talk about." And he hung up. So B. David remains an international man of mystery. But what's particularly funny is that through various triangulations and whatnot, you know, I now have FBI files about him. I have all sorts of things. But I tell you, he is not mentioned by name in my book, because that was one of the three rules. And it's an interesting thing. Again, a Jason Scott quote. You know, as I was complaining to him at one point, because some of the phone freaks I dealt with for the book are just, they're fantastic people, they're friendly. And as I should say, by the way, the phone company people and the FBI agents, some of the happiest, best-adjusted people you will ever meet, just really nice people. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about was, well, if you're an FBI agent, what's, like, one of the things you need? Well, you got to like people. You got to like interacting with people. And that tends to make people, I think, happier later in life. But on the other hand, a few of the phone freaks, by no means all, but a handful, really kind of strange. And yeah, shocking, right? Look at me. Jason Scott's comment, he said, well, Phil, you're talking about a group of people whose claim to fame was abusing a piece of equipment for hours on end until it did something they can brag about to their friends. Oddly enough, this doesn't always lead to great outcomes later in life, you know? But at the same time, you know, that's us, right? That's how many of the people in this room are, and it is what it is. So, you know, you see all kinds. You see the very helpful phone freaks, and you see the slightly more paranoid, you know, I want 10% of the royalties of your book kind of people. Okay. So I'd like to conclude with a few lessons learned here. Again, after first ogling an FBI evidence thing of a reel of magnetic tape with an evidence tag and the FBI laboratory thing. The very first lesson that I learned from working on this book was, and this applies to any project, whether it's a book, any big project, is a project like this is way harder than you think, right? It takes longer. It involves more people. It requires, well, frankly, giving a piggyback ride to John Draper in his front room, you know? That's if you want to get an interview from John, that's what you're going to do. And if you thought about it, you probably wouldn't do it, right? I mean, that's the reality of it. And so, therefore, the lesson number two is don't think about it too hard, right? Because if you want to, you know, it's true, again, of any big project is once you're starting off, you know, once you're on this path, you really want to, you just really want to let it go. And you want to commit to it and you want to do it totally. And so I've tried not to think about that too much. And fortunately, I'm married to an extremely understanding wife who supported me in this. Lesson number three is save everything. Even if you're not doing any sort of historical project, you never know when somebody like me is going to show up and say, hey, I want to talk to you about this amazing thing that you were involved in. And believe me, when I talk to various both phone freaks and telephone company security agents, but especially the telephone company security agents, they would say things like, what do you mean this special thing I was involved in? I was a phone company security agent, for God's sake. How special is that, right? Still, I want to hear about your story because I think there are people who are interested in it. And in many cases, these people would just save, just they were pack rats, and they would you know, you saw that photo of Ken Hopper and all of the documents, and that was repeated time after time after time. I talked to one guy who's a telephone company security agent for Southern Bell, had a conversation with him on the phone. 2 weeks later, a big box of stuff shows up. This guy is in his 80s, so I go through the box of stuff, just great documents. You know, I call him back. I said, "Oh, yeah, I'll send it back to you." He's like, "Oh, no, I really don't need that at this point. You know, you can just keep it." You know, so pack rats are just incredibly important to historians. So if you have anything that you think is of historical value, scan it, digitize it, whatever. You can get rid of the paper if you want, but please save it because it's going to be important to somebody someplace. So the final thing that I didn't really expect going into this was if you think what the phone freaks did was impressive, try inventing the telephone system from scratch.